In this hour of the program, we are looking for your questions on healthcare, and our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carle Clinic in Urbana. He is with us every other month, always on a Monday, in the 11 o'clock hour, and we have built it into the schedule so that you'll have an opportunity to ask general healthcare questions. He sees people of all ages in his practice, so this could be a question about grown-ups, can be a question about children, for you, for someone in your family. All you have to do is call in. And one of the things that I suggest to people that they keep in mind right up front when we do programs like this is because the doctor cannot see you, there are limitations. We obviously cannot do diagnosis over the phone. But at the same time, I don't want to discourage anyone from calling. We do these programs to be a resource for you. This can be a place to start. Or if you're interested in some general kind of knowledge on some topic, I know the doctor would do his best to answer your question. And then if you need to go from there, obviously you need to pursue that with your own physician or with someone who can see you. But having said all that, questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have the toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere you can hear us, 800-222-9455. So, and whichever one works best for you, you can give us a call. Well, thank you very much for being here.
I'm glad to be back,
David. We appreciate it. Are we now at the end where we're going to be pretty much done with flu now?
I think the winter virus season is now officially over. The flu for adults and kids, and RSV, which is a respiratory syncytial virus, mostly in children, has really, really tapered off in the last few weeks, and we're not seeing much of that at all anymore.
Okay. Well, good. That's good.
Yeah.
We'll see if we can. We'll get into some new stuff, and I suppose one of the things we are approaching here is, for some folks, we're going to start allergy problems, maybe even people already, because there are things out there that are blooming and going.
Sure.
People already are starting to have some symptoms.
The other thing that we saw here just within the last week was a brief outbreak of mild depression in the general public after the Illini lost their last game.
But
they seem to be getting over it and enjoying the fine season that they had.
Well, if the team can get over it, surely the fans can get
That's
over
right.
it. I also, someone that I am acquainted with said recently that here in his home, he was dealing with a little outbreak of fifth disease. And I mentioned that to some folks, and it actually is something that we have talked about with our pediatrician. But when, having mentioned that to some people, they said, "What? What is that? I have never heard of this thing." And then I told them the story of you know, what it was and how it got that name.
Right. It's the next one in line after fourth disease. Exactly. There was a whole series of viral illnesses that got numbered. The other ones now have more common names, but the fifth disease was never really given the a new name, so it has stuck with that. But primarily a viral illness, mostly in kids, though occasionally an adult, but not very commonly. Fever and rash tends to be fairly contagious, so it will indeed run through schools, daycares, and that sort of thing. But generally, other than the fever associated with, not a terribly serious illness, and generally self-limited.
Yeah. That was one of the, I thought the story is really good about how this was, and I think if I remember right, it was a German physician, and that he was coming up with, he was cataloging these diseases. They were viral illnesses that caused some kind of rash.
Right.
And he started out by just saying there was number one, two, three, four. And German measles is one of them.
Measles, mumps, rubella, which is the German measles.
Those
right.
things. And I just, it's just sort of funny. All those things got names. How come fifth?
I don't know if don't they ran know. Out of names or I don't know.
He couldn't come up with another name for the disease. All right. In any case, and this is something that you just you treat the symptoms and then just try to keep the person comfortable, and there's really nothing else in particular that you can do for that.
The problem is that when it initially starts out, if there's significant fever, obviously, you know, parents in terms of their kids are worried about, does it represent some other kind of illness, and they're often brought in, you know, to check and make sure they don't have an ear infection or you know, tonsillitis or some other infectious process where an antibiotic might actually be appropriate.
And there's no vaccine for this?
No.
No. Okay. Just because it's not particularly serious?
That, and I'm not sure that it's ever been isolated well enough to create the vaccine for.
Oh. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, again, other questions are welcome. Health questions, that's what we're doing here this morning with our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen from Carle Clinic in Urbana. It's the show that we call Talk to the Family Doctor. Whatever questions you might have are certainly welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Something I thought I might ask you to talk about, and I expect we probably have talked about this before, and that has to do with concerns about pain-killing medications, particularly the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory medicines that a lot of people take who have arthritis, and but particularly those that are in the category called COX-2 inhibitors like Bextra, Celebrex, and
Vioxx.
And I guess the reason that I bring it up is because just now recently, Bextra has been pulled, and that the other medicines have also, their concerns been raised about them, although the concerns aren't the same with each one. And I think that it was Celebrex that the thought is that it doesn't come in with as many problems as the other ones, so maybe in some circumstances it's still okay. What do you think about now for these medicines?
Well, originally there were the three COX-2 inhibitors. Vioxx has already been removed from the market, and most recently Bextra was removed from the market as well. Both of those shared concerns about potential increased risk of cardiovascular diseases such as strokes and heart attacks, at a rate higher than people not taking those medications. The Celebrex is still on the market. There will be ongoing studies looking at whether it has any cardiovascular implications. The COX-2 inhibitors here generally are not better medications as an anti-inflammatory agent than anything else that's already out there. It's just that they are, in large-scale trials, a little less likely to cause stomach upset. And that's the major common side effect from any of the anti-inflammatory agents. If you take large doses for a long period of time and don't take them with food or something to protect your stomach, you can basically end up with ulcer-like symptoms. People have eaten holes in their stomach, and you know it's caused some major problems. There are also some potential concerns about kidney function long-term in people who take anti-inflammatory agents. The interesting study that compared acetaminophen, which is not a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory agent, with a lot of the other typical ones, and these are your ibuprofen, naproxen-type medications, basically found that in large population studies, acetaminophen was just as effective as a pain reliever as any of the other anti-inflammatory agents in individuals who had the most common form of arthritis, which is osteoarthritis, what we call degenerative joint disease. It's simply the mechanical wearing away of the lining of the joint due to age and use, and sometimes injury. And in those particular cases, if acetaminophen works as well, I basically have been encouraging folks to try that first, because it's not going to eat a hole in their stomach. It's not going to interfere with kidney function. Now, in individuals who have pre-existing liver disease, there is a potential problem. High-dose acetaminophen can indeed be a liver problem, but typically at the usual doses, that's not very common.
Hmm. What do you caution people about? Because I think there also have been some questions raised about some of the other medications that you mentioned that are available over the counter.
Right.
That you can just go in there and go into the pharmacy and or wherever and buy it.
Ibuprofen is sold as Motrin and Advil. Naproxen is sold as Aleve. These are indeed over-the-counter medications. The only thing different between them is the dose that they come in. The over-the-counter dose of Advil is 200 milligrams of ibuprofen. If you're taking a maximum daily dose of ibuprofen, you'd be taking 800 milligrams three times a day. So that would be essentially 12 Advil tablets a day. Hmm. And that's a therapeutic dose if you're looking for the anti-inflammatory effect. Now, if you're just using it as a mild pain reliever because you have a headache, sometimes all you need is a couple of tablets once or twice, and that's generally not going to be a problem. But for somebody taking high doses for long periods of time, the over-the-counter medications have just as many potential complications as any prescription anti-inflammatory arthritis drug.
Mm-hmm. And what if for those people who you might, and we should say that you shouldn't be taking them at the therapeutic dose unless your doctor says that. Don't do that on your own. For people who are using one of those medications, do you then do something for them, or is there something that you can do for them to try to counter the stomach upset part?
Yes. In many instances, we always tell them take it with food. Just have something in your stomach to buffer it from the medication. A variety of the medications that are sold as antacids, the Tagamet, Zantac, Axid, Pepcid-type medications, if used regularly, can be helpful in minimizing irritation to the stomach. And for some individuals, we'll go beyond that, and there's a class of drugs referred to as PPIs. And one of those is now available over the counter. That's Prilosec OTC. These are stronger medications in terms of preventing acid production. Also seem to be helpful in protecting the stomach. And then there's finally a prescription product called Cytotec that has been specifically marketed to be used to protect the stomach of individuals who've had previous problems with irritation to their stomach from anti-inflammatory medications.
Okay. Well, we have someone here to talk with on a cell phone. We'll do that, and it's line number one.
Yes, you mentioned seasonal allergies, and I've been taking Nasacort. Is it possible that you can build up immunity to it, and is there a next generation of nasal steroids when that happens?
It's not really so much that you build up an immunity to it as people not uncommonly develop new allergies or during certain parts of the season, their symptoms are simply worse because the burden of allergens that they're exposed to increases. There are perhaps a half a dozen different nasal steroids used for helping prevent seasonal allergy symptoms. I'm not aware of any studies that compare them in terms of efficacy. That basically, there isn't one that's stronger or better than any of the others, though like with all medications, certain individuals will sometimes respond better to one than they do another. The other aspect of treating seasonal allergies, in addition to a nasal steroid, very frequently people will take an oral antihistamine, either with or without a decongestant. A number of the antihistamines are available over the counter. They will vary in terms of how much sedation they cause, but some of the newer non-sedating antihistamines are indeed available over the counter, Claritin and Allivert being common ones. At the other end of the spectrum that are quite sedating, Benadryl has been around a long time and is actually a very effective antihistamine. It just tends to be fairly sedating for a lot of folks.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Well, other questions, certainly, questions generally about health are welcome here on the program. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He is a family practice physician at Carl Clinic in Urbana. And this is a program we call Talk to the Family Doctor, and we do it every other month to give you an opportunity to call in and ask health questions. I know the doctor will do his best to give me an answer, help you out. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number. Also, we do have a toll-free line, 800-222-9455. And here's someone else to talk with in Urbana. Line number two.
Hello.
Yes.
I understand that the painkiller called Oxycontin is being, Well, you have to go to the doctor every month to get checked because they think people are abusing the drug. Do you know about that?
I'm not aware of a requirement for patients to see their physician every month regarding that.
Well, this is what I heard, so I just wanted to know what you knew about it.
That would be something new to me, but you are correct. OxyContin is a very potent narcotic pain medication, and it has been subjected to a fair amount of abuse, and there's been a lot more publicity about it, and there's been a lot of discussion in the medical community about using it appropriately. And one thing that may indeed be currently suggested, though I'm not aware that it's an actual requirement, is for those patients to be monitored very closely in terms of their use.
Well, is it that much stronger or that much worse than other painkillers?
It's up there.
It's up there.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you.
All right. Let's talk with someone here. We have someone on a cell phone here somewhere around Mohammed. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
My question is that lately I've been meeting a lot of people who I know who are over the age of 60. And I've noticed that there's been they've reported a number of cases of shingles. And I was just wondering, I know what it is, but what is usually the beginning age of onset? And how do you know the symptoms before the rash? I know there's pain, but I understand if you can have an injection in the early stages to reduce the inflammation that eventually occurs. But I guess what I'm looking for, what are the early signs of it?
For the benefit of some of our other listeners, we'll just briefly go through shingles, which is the common name used for herpes zoster, which is actually the reactivation of the chickenpox virus in your system. People who had chickenpox as a child typically retain the virus in their body. It typically lives in nerve roots associated with the spinal cord. And for a variety of reasons, this virus can become reactivated, sometimes as a result of trauma, sometimes illness, sometimes a change in the immune system. Due to medication, and other times we really don't know why it becomes reactivated, but it generally will follow the nerve root from the spinal cord. So typically the rash associated with shingles extends from the middle of the back, usually comes around the trunk. This is the most common location to have it, and produces a vesicular or blister-like lesion that eventually dries and crusts and goes away, kind of like chicken pox dries up and eventually goes away. You can get it on the extremities. You can get it on the face or scalp. And it, again, it'll follow a nerve root pattern. So there's usually just a fairly narrow band of these skin lesions. The problem is that it's in the nerve, and the reactivation of this virus in the nerve is very, very painful. It hurts a lot. And until the rash is visibly present, it's virtually impossible to make the diagnosis. And every physician in primary care has had the experience of a patient coming in complaining of pain. You don't find anything, and 2 days later they're back in your office, and you go, aha, now that the rash is there, I know exactly what you have. But the most common warning is indeed pain along the nerve root. But in the absence of directly seeing the rash, it's impossible to tell. That pain often starts as a prickly, irritated, burning kind of sensation. Anybody who's ever been able to sense a cold sore or fever blister coming on will recognize kind of what that feels like. But when it does come on, there are specific antiviral medications that can be given to help shorten the duration that the virus is active. And the injection that you're referring to is usually a cortisone medication, and that can be usually given either by injection or orally as well. it's not curative, but it does indeed tend to decrease the amount of inflammation and discomfort associated with it. There are some studies that suggest that the cortisone medications, if given early enough in the course, may help decrease what is called postherpetic neuralgia. These are the few unfortunate folks who, even after their skin lesions dry up and go away, continue to have pain in the nerve, and that can be very debilitating. Fortunately, it's not a common problem. We do see it a little bit more commonly in adults, but have seen shingles in children as well. So there is no specific age range where it does or doesn't occur. But it's always in somebody who's been exposed to the chickenpox virus in the past. Now, these days, that may include children who've been immunized for chickenpox as well.
Oh, I see. And now, I did hear that being immunized for chickenpox as an adult will not help or will not do anything to prevent the occurrence of the shingles. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right.
You may still get it even though you've been immunized.
Once you have it, is it often, can it reoccur or does it reoccur?
Very, very unusual. Almost all individuals who have shingles have it once.
In the lifetime.
Correct.
But are there any more people, for example, does it tend to run in families? For example, if siblings or family members have had it in the past, is it more likely that one could develop it?
Not at all. It's simply dependent on whether you yourself have had exposure to the chickenpox virus.
Right. So, and do you also see any particular season that it tends to be? Chickenpox used to be, I don't know, in the spring, and then I heard people in the fall, or children I meant be having it.
I'm not aware of any seasonal distribution for shingles itself, no.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're all right, thanks.
Information.
Very good. Just two more quick questions here for the doctor. One, certainly we know chickenpox is contagious. Shingles, can you get shingles?
Shingles is not contagious.
Okay. But isn't it true that if you have not had chickenpox, you could actually get chickenpox from someone who has shingles?
If you manage to take unbroken skin on your body and grind it into an open blister on their body, yes. But as a general rule, since most of these are on the trunk, if you have your shirt on, no.
Unlike.
So simply sitting next to somebody with shingles is not going to give you shingles. In rare instances, you'd have to have direct physical contact and transfer of some of the fluid from one of the blisters onto broken skin on somebody who previously hadn't had chickenpox or hadn't been immunized against it.
Okay. So it sounds like the chances are slim to none.
Right. We routinely do not, quarantine people. We don't tell them that they have to stay home or do anything. If they have a job, in the public, we basically tell them as long as it's covered, it should not be a concern.
All right. And again, just to ask the question about the immunization, do we know whether people who, children, we give them the chickenpox vaccine, now as we're doing, would they be just as likely as adults to develop shingles, or do we not know?
Don't know yet.
Okay.
But the chickenpox vaccine hasn't been really around long enough for us to follow kids far enough into the future to be able to say whether it's going to reduce the likelihood of outbreaks of shingles or whether their outbreaks won't be as bad or whether it's simply going to be the same as anybody else who's had the chickenpox.
Very good. Our guest this morning here on Focus 580, Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor from Carl Clinic in Urbana. This is the program we call Talk to the Family Doctor. And whatever questions you have, they're certainly welcome. We have several people lined up, ready to go. And the next is someone in Mattoon. Line number 4. Hello.
Good morning. Mm-hmm. Doctor, I have a neuropathy in my leg. And as a result, I have a foot drop. it's been recommended that a tendon transfer might help that foot. Have you had any, do you have any knowledge of whether that is successful?
This would actually be a question better directed to an orthopedic surgeon, but yes, in some instances, the transfer of a tendon to allow the foot to come back up has indeed been successful. This is something that's obviously going to depend on your sort of fitness for surgery, whether you have other potential complicating medical factors that would be a problem in terms of having the operation or healing up. But it's certainly not an unreasonable option to pursue and find out more about.
I'm 78, and I'm generally in very good health.
Mm-hmm.
But my neurologist has said that it's quite a procedure for a person my age to go through.
I would say people who are generally healthy at the age of 78 go through much bigger procedures, like when they get a total knee replaced or, you know, a hip replacement.
And I've had both of those done.
So if you've done that, this isn't going to be any bigger than that.
I see. All right. Well, I appreciate your thoughts. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thank you. Let's talk next with someone in line number 2, and this is a listener in Champaign. Hello.
Howdy, Doc. I am in perfect health and intend to stay that way, but I got a public health question for you. As a kid, I heard of tetanus and lockjaw, and I thought lockjaw wouldn't be so bad, so your jaws are locked, you just get fed between your teeth or something. And then the other day I happened to see a movie that showed someone in the terminal stages of tetanus poison, looked it up and realized it was a bacterial cause and neurotoxin. Very nasty way to die. Now, what is... all of us get pin punctures or pin pricks and other kind of punctures wound from time to time.
Mm-hmm.
Is tetanus a major public health concern now? How are the booster shots going? Do a lot of people get them? Have we had a lot of tetanus here in Champaign County, or is it completely a non-issue?
It's really, to be honest, a non-issue because of the immunization practices. Tetanus is routinely given to infants in the newborn period. It's updated in school throughout high school. And then as you see your regular physician over time, adults should indeed get a tetanus booster about every 10 years. Now, for some individuals who might run into more significant exposures, maybe every 5 years on a tetanus booster is a reasonable thing to do. Tetanus is actually, as you pointed out, a bacteria that exists in our environment. It's actually in the ground. In the ground, it's in spore form. It's just sort of hibernating. But this is why if you run around outside in your bare feet and then step on that rusty nail, you're at risk for acquiring tetanus. Now, your typical paper cut in the office is not a source of tetanus.
Okay.
So that is not a concern there. It's typically the contaminated wounds, especially anything that would involve soil. And
okay,
well, go ahead.
Yeah, I understand. So a pinprick from a sewing by someone sewing is not a problem, but a puncture wound to a mechanic, for instance, who's around dirty grease all day, maybe.
Your farmers, your construction workers, mm-hmm. Yes, all of those folks would be much more likely.
Okay, well, thanks for your help.
Okay, thanks. I suppose, though, even if you were just a gardener,
yes,
and you were digging around in the dirt,
that's exactly.
There's also the possibility there. So it may be that might argue for wearing some protective, some gloves or something like that that would protect you against if you came up against something sharp or mm-hmm. whatever to minimize your direct contact with the soil.
Probably. That's correct.
All right. Very good. And again, we'll go to someone in Chicago. This is line number 3. Hello.
Yes, hello. I have a question about someone with I know who has type 2 diabetes, a relative actually, and while she had a cold recently, they had given her some prescription medicine for the cough called Tussianic suspension. It has a form of codeine in it called hydrocodone. And during this time while she was taking this medicine on her, this cough syrup, prescription cough syrup on a daily basis, her blood sugar readings were lowered about 30, 40 points every morning, and it seemed to regulate her blood sugar. And would it be the codeine or the hydrocodone that actually does that, or are you familiar with that at all?
I'm familiar with the product, but I'm not aware of any direct effect on blood sugar other than if you're not feeling well and you're not eating, your blood sugar might be down a little bit. But no, I'm not aware of any direct effect of the medication itself or its active ingredient on the the blood sugar.
I think it is related to the medicine because she's taken it from time to time when she's had a cough after having had the flu. She had some left over, and she still, every time she takes it, it seems to lower her sugar. I've asked other doctors about this. They're not aware of it either. I just thought that perhaps there was something you might be aware of that, for her it was a good result, but I can imagine if someone's taking insulin shots or something and they're taking this medicine at the same time, that could be a danger.
Well, you point out a good observation, which is most diabetic patients are asked at any time when their regular routine is disrupted during times of illness or injury. They should indeed be much more attentive about checking their blood sugars frequently, because in some instances, a change in diet, a change in fluid intake, new medications or changes in doses of medication can indeed affect blood sugar, either up or down. And it's important for diabetic patients to keep their sugars as well controlled as they can during time periods of other illnesses so that they don't actually get sicker by having their diabetes get out of control.
Yes, I understand. Well, thank you very much for your help.
Thank you.
All right. Well, again, thank you for the call. And other people who are listening, if you have questions for our guest, Dr. Jeff Swearingen, you can call us here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. It's good anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois and Indiana. That is 800-222-9455. A little bit earlier, we were talking about over-the-counter treatments, medicines that are involved to treat symptoms of either allergy or cold.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, to deal with feelings of congestion, stuffy nose, all that kind of stuff, there are decongestants and there are antihistamines. And you can get them packaged together. You can get them separately. So that's what I think sometimes people get confused by in when they look at allergy, cough, cold remedies.
Mm-hmm.
You go there and there are all these different products. And there may be some combination of things. There's mm-hmm. stuff if you have a cough. There's stuff if you just have a headache and you feel bad. There's stuff if you're all stuffed up. There's stuff, you know. And that's why it's probably a good idea first to figure out, what are my symptoms? What am I trying to do here? And what do I want to take for it so that you don't end up taking something that you don't really need?
Right. And I will show a little of my bias here. Most of the heavily advertised over-the-counter medications that are, quote, brand name, your Advil, cold and sinus, Tylenol, cold and, you know, those sorts of things, in my opinion, are great marketing, but don't really offer any significant advantage over things that you can buy individually and certainly at much less cost. Tylenol is acetaminophen. It's available generically in large quantities for very little money. Advil and Motrin are both brand names for ibuprofen, again, available generically. The Tylenol and Advil-type medications, if you're feverish, if you're achy, can be very helpful. Okay? So that's primarily the benefit that you're going to get from that portion of the medication. The decongestants are typically variants of Sudafed. Pseudoephedrine, which is the chemical name, is again available over the counter generically very cheaply. So in that regard, if you need a decongestant and want to take something, that would be a reasonable thing to do. In my experience, the world's best decongestant is to drink more water. a nice, hot, steamy shower. All of those things can be very, very helpful in terms of relieving congestion, and there aren't any medical side effects from drinking more water. The antihistamines come in a wide variety of chemicals, ranging, as we talked about before, from the non-sedating ones like Claritin to the very sedating Benadryl. Benadryl is actually, in its chemical form, diphenhydramine, and it's a very commonly used antihistamine in a variety of over-the-counter medications, including most of the common sleep aids. Because of its sedative side effects, diphenhydramine is often an ingredient in over-the-counter sleeping aids. So the antihistamines are generally most useful for people who have allergy-related symptoms. Antihistamines have never really been shown to offer any significant benefit to viral illnesses like colds. I really don't see any reason to take it. The decongestants can be very briefly helpful on a temporary basis. If you have a little fever, some ibuprofen or acetaminophen is not at all reasonable. But it basically boils down to there isn't any cure for the cold, and you're going to simply have it run its course. You're going to do best if you keep yourself very, very well hydrated, make sure you get plenty of rest, and basically observe for any worsening. Certainly a viral illness could set you up for a bronchitis or a pneumonia or a sinus infection. So if you're running high fevers or developing other more localized symptoms, it's certainly reasonable to check with your physician. But if it's your sort of garden variety cold, treating it symptomatically and putting up with it is about all there is to do.
Okay. Well, that's. I think you answered the one of the questions that I had was that essentially I was thinking about what is the difference between the decongestant and the antihistamine? Because it somehow in my mind, I guess I thought that they were different and they worked differently, and yet they did kind of the same thing.
Well, in allergies, when what you're exposed to, the allergen, comes in contact with the mucosa, the lining of the nose and the sinuses, the part of the allergic response is the release of histamine. Histamine then generates a whole chemical cascade of other things that causes your nose to swell up and for you to sneeze, and you got all this runny drainage. And you can block that response with the antihistamines. That's essentially what they're for. Now, there is some histamine released with a cold, but not nearly as much as it is with allergies. The decongestants basically are what we call vasoconstrictors. They go to the small blood vessels in the lining of the nose and the sinuses and cause the blood vessels to actually constrict down, limiting the amount of blood and therefore the amount of fluid that can be exuded through the lining of the nose. And this is kind of how it helps open up your nasal passages.
Okay. So that's that. Okay, good. Well, now I think I got that. I generally try to avoid decongestants because they have an unpleasant side effect. They make you feel really buzzy, like you've had way too much coffee.
Right.
And so I generally, and some myself, people, I don't like it.
And some people don't tolerate them well because of that stimulant sort of side effect. They'll notice that their heart races or they have more palpitations, and they get that edgy feeling like they've had too much coffee.
Yeah. All right. Very good. Well, let's talk with someone else here. We have a caller in Flossmoor, and it's line number 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Well, good morning.
Yes.
I had an experience a couple of weeks ago, and my doctor didn't really seem to know what it was, and I wondered if you did. On a Tuesday, I believe, I was with a group of people, and they said, "Your face is so red." And I, oh, well. And then on Friday evening, I was looking at myself in the mirror, and all the wrinkles around my eyes had disappeared. So my face was swollen. So my doctor gave me an antibiotic right away, and which he doesn't approve of. And I went to see him on Monday, and he really had no idea what it was. Do you?
How were you otherwise feeling at this time?
Well, I had a little fever, like 1 degree. And I felt very, very, very tired. baffling. I mean.
And did you have, at the time that you then saw your physician, an active sinus infection?
Oh, no. No, I didn't. He did ask me on Saturday. He said, you know, does it hurt if you press your face? And I said, yes. But, of course, by Monday, that had gone. I'd taken the antibiotic.
Mm-hmm. With the assumption that the antibiotic actually helped, an underlying sinus infection would be at least in the right location for your initial symptoms.
But my sinuses weren't hurting me, I mean.
But he asked you if they were tender to touch.
Oh, what was tender was the top of my cheekbones.
Right, and that's where your maxillary...
Is that a sinus, too?
That's where your maxillary sinuses are.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So it's possible that you simply had an early sinus infection brewing that you know, after a couple of days on antibiotics was starting to settle down, so he didn't have a whole lot to see by the time you got in. Alternatively, especially in women, after menopause, hot flashes are something that will cause the, you know, some facial flushing, generally not swelling, but most women are aware of it when, you know, they feel very warm and get flushed.
So
I'm assuming that's not the case.
No, it wasn't
here.
Like that. I did try to read something on the Internet, and they talked about infections under your skin, but I...
Well, what's called
kind of far-fetched.
Well, what's called cellulitis is an infection in the soft tissues of the skin.
Uh-huh.
When they occur on the face, it's usually as a result of either some type of oral lesion or some type of nasal lesion, because bacteria in the nose and the mouth will occasionally, through a break in the skin, get underneath the surface of the skin and then spread. But that's usually fairly severe when it occurs.
Well, this was just unpleasant, you know. Hmm. The tiredness was...
And certainly the low-grade fever and the tiredness can be seen with infectious processes.
Yeah.
There's no question about that.
Well, it's just kind of a puzzle.
Well,
and you're saying about what he did, too. But, then he just talked about allergy. I didn't really think that was allergy.
Allergies generally will not give you fever.
No, I didn't know that.
And would not actually improve with antibiotics.
So that's true.
Right.
All right. Well, thank you.
Well, we're glad you're a puzzle and feeling better than the other way around.
Yeah, I'm feeling much better.
Okay.
Okay, very good.
Doctor.
Well, we have maybe about 5-6 minutes left here in this part of Focus 580. Our guest is Dr. Jeff Swearingen. He's a family practice doctor at Carle Clinic. He's with us every other month for the show we call Talk to the Family Doctor. And the idea is that whatever questions you might have about, could be for yourself, could be for someone in your family, you can call in and talk about it with the doctor. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. And we do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. One of the things that I think people now know about, have certainly heard about, we've talked about it, it's gotten a lot of attention in the media, is concern about the overuse of antibiotics. And the concern is that if we're careless in the way that we prescribe them and take them, we might encourage resistance in the bacteria that we want to treat. And so we might find ourselves one day with antibiotics that we had used in the past not working anymore.
Correct.
And that could get to be a real serious problem if we burn through all of our antibiotics and then suddenly we don't have anything
use. And that's happening today in the hospital situation.
Mm-hmm.
As you can well imagine, there are a lot of unusual infectious diseases that end up being concentrated in hospitals. There's a large amount of antibiotic usage for those patients in hospitals, and they are actually over time developing resistance to more and more antibiotics. And some of the more severe infections that hospitalized patients get are becoming very, very difficult to treat. And the concern is that this same process smaller scale is going to be more widespread throughout the general population. And in fact, the use of antibiotics for generally viral illnesses doesn't convey any benefit to the person taking them, but does indeed expose the bacteria in their body to that antibiotic, and some of those bacteria will then develop resistance to it and may become a source of infection that will be worse in the future because of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I guess I'm thinking about, particularly as we're now coming off the flu and the cold season, where you and other physicians would be seeing people who had viral illness, mm-hmm. but in some cases there might be, and I guess I don't completely understand how this could be, but there might be some sort of secondary or additional bacterial infection. Right. So someone might have had a persistent cold that just they can't seem to shake it, and then they might go on to develop something like bronchitis, or they might have a sinus infection or something right. that would then indeed respond to antibiotic.
Right.
I guess I'm wondering how you think about making the decision to write that prescription.
This actually is a fairly common problem, and I would be willing to bet varies considerably from physician to physician as to sort of where they draw the line as to whether they're going to treat with antibiotics or not. You're correct. A preceding viral infection can disturb your immune system enough that either exposure to exogenous bacteria or simply allowing bacteria that are present in your system now to overgrow can cause a secondary infection. But in fact, your sinuses, your bronchial tubes, your lung, you can have primary viral sinusitis. You can have primary viral bronchitis. You can have a viral pneumonia. And in some instances, it's very, very difficult on clinical grounds to separate that out from an underlying bacterial infection. And this is where it starts to get a little bit more complicated. Somebody whose symptoms are lasting longer than the typical viral illness, somebody whose symptoms are more severe, and then you get into laboratory testing. What does their chest x-ray, their sinus x-ray look like? What does their blood count look like? There are certain types of bacterial infections that we can test for. Are those positive or not? Certainly, if on clinical grounds or additional laboratory studies, you can get a preponderance of the evidence to suggest a bacterial process, then it's probably very reasonable to use antibiotics in that particular situation. In some higher risk patients, we may be more inclined to cover the possibility of a bacterial infection. You take your diabetic patient who may not tolerate a bacterial infection very well. We may be a little bit more inclined to be more aggressive with antibiotic usage in that patient's just hoping that we're at least doing what we can for bacterial processes. If they have a viral illness, it's not going to make any difference. But in many instances, we don't want to wait for them to be sick enough to definitely prove that they have a bacterial infection because they're not going to tolerate that as well as a healthy person.
Hmm. Okay. We have time at least for one more, I think. Champagne here, line one. Hello.
Yes. I just want to ask you about something that I've had since I was a child. It took me a long time to figure out what it was, but it's called sleep paralysis, where I will be knowing that I'm lying in bed and I can't move for a few seconds before I wake up. And it's actually very, very frightening because you have to shake yourself awake. I've looked at it on the net and so forth, and I'm wondering, is there anywhere or any place near here that does research on that, or are there any kinds of drugs that you recommend, medicines and so on? It never increases necessarily. When I was a child, I had it a lot, and it doesn't seem to be progressive or anything like that or dangerous, but it's extremely frightening.
Right, and it's not that common. I don't have a lot of personal knowledge of this particular subject. I'm off the top of my head not aware of any medication that's necessarily given to help prevent this. I can tell you that the sleep lab here at the Carle Clinic is very actively involved in all sorts of research projects regarding sleep disorders, and in fact, Dr. Piketty would probably be the person that I would recommend to you.
Oh, great.
He actually is a very well-recognized sleep disorders expert. And if anybody's going to know, that's probably where I would refer you to.
Oh, fantastic. Okay, I was hoping someone close would at least look at me.
Mm-hmm.
See
yes.
if there's any, what the possibilities are. Okay, thank you very much.
All right, thank you for the call. Well, I think at that we're pretty much going to have to wrap it up for this time around. My apologies, we have a caller that we can't take. However, a couple months, Dr. Jeff will be back, and we will do it again.
It'll be my pleasure.
Dr. Jeff Swearingen, he's a family practice physician from Carl Clinic in Urbana. He's here for the show. We call Talk to the Family Doctor. We do it every other month. It's always on a Monday in the 11 o'clock hour.